Hi, it's Colleen O'Brien for Sharp Vision Modern LASIK. I can't believe I waited so long to have LASIK. 2018 is your year for LASIK. Don't wait another year. For a limited time, receive $1,000 off your LASIK procedure. Go online to schedule your free consultation.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Dr. Garen Wintemute is the director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. And we contacted him because he wrote this op-ed a few months ago in which he suggested that as a way to reduce the number of gun deaths in America, that physicians ask their patients whether they have a gun in the home. And tell us about your background, first of all. You've been an emergency room physician for a long time, and you also have done quite a bit of gun violence research, right?
That's correct.
So how would this conversation go that you suggest physicians initiate in the exam room?
Sure. So it varies with the circumstances. So for me as an ER doc, often the conversation is with someone I'm talking with who's in the department because they're suicidal. So I'm obviously going to approach the issue fairly directly. Mm-hmm. I don't recommend that doctors routinely ask this question. It's a question, the question would be, do you have access to firearms in and around your home or something like that? But it's a question to be asked when it's directly relevant. If a person is depressed and drinking, if the patient is a young child, I'm asking the parents. If I'm seeing a woman whose partner has been violent, there are a number of specific circumstances where it's directly relevant. Even in those circumstances, we doctors don't traditionally do a very good job of asking, and that's the change that we're suggesting.
So, and I was just looking at your website, you suggest beginning the conversation by saying, now I want to ask you a couple of questions about firearms. Are there any firearms in or around your home? Do any of these firearms belong to you? Who has access to them? Have you tried this, and do patients actually answer?
Well, sure. I don't always use exactly those words, but I do this probably every shift I work because I see somebody for whom it is directly relevant. I will have asked questions about other risk factors or in some way established the relevance. And then I'll say something like, you know, in situations like this, I need to be concerned about weapons or access to means of committing suicide, if that's the nature of the conversation we're having. And then I will say, so I ask about things like guns. So are there any weapons, any firearms, et cetera? And I go from there. But I've established a context that makes the question relevant to the patient. And I, both in my own experience and there's scientific literature on this, the vast majority of patients are entirely willing to have that question asked of them when they think it's relevant.
Really? So you've had patients say, thank you for asking, you're right, I'm feeling suicidal, I better get rid of the gun?
Yes, really? I have. Yeah. I've taken firearms off people in the emergency department. That hasn't happened in a long time. But yes, let's stick with my specific situation.
Yeah.
If someone has come to the hospital because they're suicidal, they're asking for help. And this is one way of providing that help, is uncoupling the intent from the means to accomplish it. And we know of people who actually attempt suicide with firearms and survive, that the vast majority of them are glad to be alive, and only a very small percentage go on to attempt again. So yes, they perceive it as help and are grateful.
Would this ever come up during the course of just say a routine physical?
Asked that way, I would say the answer is, at least for me, generally not. I would need personally to believe that that line of questioning was somehow relevant, as I would for just about any question that I ask. So if the person I'm doing the exam on has no risk factors for violence, I'm not going to ask because the answer is not relevant. Right. But if I'm talking to somebody who's, at the time I'm seeing them, they're intoxicated and they're really angry, and I'm seeing them for an injury, and I see in the record that we've seen them for injuries before, and they're trash talking the person who did this to them. In such a situation, I might bring the subject up.
Mm-hmm. All right, that makes sense. So I think it's fair to say that what's got people's attention these days are, of course, school shootings and shootings where that are not suicides. Even though I realize suicide is the main cause of death for people with guns. Mm-hmm. How do you bring it up when we're talking about someone who clearly holds a grudge, or where there's a domestic abuse involved, or where there's a student who perhaps feels bullied and has come to your office and shares that with you?
Yes. So the answer varies from state to state. We have something here in California, and you have in Washington. We give it different names. I'm going to use the California name. We call it a gun violence restraining order. In Washington, you call it an extreme risk protection order. And here in California, we're actually studying our approach to this. So in both states, the details vary, but in both states, I, as a physician, can either talk to family or talk to law enforcement. They, in turn, can go to a judge, just as is done for domestic violence. Our statute here was modeled on our domestic violence statute, and ask for a restraining order. In essence, they have to make the case to a judge that, Your Honor, there's a problem here. No crime has been committed, so we can't arrest a person. They're not acutely suicidal, so they don't need to be in the hospital. But it seems clear to us that something that risk is very high in the near term, and firearms are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And if the judge agrees, following specified rules of evidence, they can issue an order that prohibits the individual from purchasing or possessing firearms. And that order is typically served by law enforcement, and those firearms are recovered. It's a temporary order. It's only good for 3 weeks, at least in California. And if there's a need to extend the order, if the situation hasn't changed, there has to be a hearing so that the person who's been served with the order has a chance to make the case that it's inappropriate.
And have you done that? And have any of the physicians who read your op-ed done that?
I have not personally, and I don't know of a case where someone has done so in response to something I've written. These policies are just taking off. There have only been a couple hundred of these orders served in California, and we've had our policy since 2016. There in Washington, I actually honestly don't know the numbers, but the policy has been around not even that long. I suspect over the next year, they'll become more common.
Yeah, we've had a couple of them. I don't think they were initiated by doctors, but it has been enforced. People have been disarmed, and I know that the police involved think that they did prevent a tragedy thanks to that law.
So as I mentioned, we are evaluating the law here in California. And through that work, I know for a fact that gun violence restraining orders have been used here to prevent at least two mass shootings, two that I know of from the records we have so far. In both cases, the people involved had made credible threats. They didn't own guns, but they had just purchased guns. The terrorist, would-be terrorist, had actually purchased an AR-15. But we here in California have a 10-day waiting period. So during the waiting period, before the guns were acquired, the order was petitioned for and issued and served. The purchases were blocked, and those two shootings did not occur. It's really simple. You can't commit a gun crime if you don't have a gun to commit it with.
Right. Is it your feeling, after your 30 years of research, that a significant percentage of these incidents can be prevented using mechanisms like this?
Yes, I do. As long as there is some evidence that people can react to. And you know, we are having this conversation in the aftermath of the Parkland shooting in Florida. Nicholas Cruz was giving off all kinds of signals, and we all understand that law enforcement dropped the ball. But somebody giving off those signals in California or Washington, his family members, not just law enforcement, could have gone to a judge. And I would add, post-Parkland, Florida has adopted a gun violence restraining order statute.
They have.
Yep.
Well, how do you feel about gun control? This is the fear of the NRA and many gun owners, that the discussion post-Parkland is going to lead to some sort of confiscation.
Well, it's not going to lead to confiscation other than of the sort we've talked about. I don't use the term gun control. I object to it. It's vague and polarizing. I am a member of the NRA. I enjoy shooting. It's not something I've done in a long time. It's one of a lot of leisure activities I've given up just for lack of time. But I think, quite honestly, my position is similar to that of many other people who are in the National Rifle Association. Firearms have a legitimate role in our society. They have a bunch of legitimate roles in our society, but nobody wants a person who's bent on doing mayhem to have a firearm to do it with.
Right.
And that's what these policies focus on.
Right. You have done, you have donated a substantial amount of money to gun research. And I got two questions on that. Number one, I thought that for a long time there was a prohibition on the most federally funded gun research. And then number two, based on those projects, have you found any other prevention methods which we have yet to adopt?
Sure. So there never was a federal ban on research. There was and is a ban on using federal funds for, actually, I'll quote directly, to advocate or promote gun control, quote unquote. What there isn't is any federal funding for research, mm-hmm. But there isn't a ban. And so it's a technical difference, but if the money showed up, theoretically, the research could continue. Yeah. And to your second question, absolutely. One policy that we think makes a difference is to require a background check and potentially a permit for every firearm purchase. Another one is to apply the prohibitions on purchasing and possessing to other groups who are at high risk. I'm going to give you just one example. People think that if you have a record of conviction for a violent crime, you can't buy a gun. That's a myth. You can have as convictions for as many violent crimes as you want under federal law. But if those crimes are not felonies and they don't involve domestic violence, you can buy all the guns you want. Here in California, we changed our policy. And if you've been convicted of violent misdemeanor crimes like assault and battery and so forth, mm-hmm. you can't buy or possess a gun for 10 years. We understand that people are young and foolish and they outgrow it. The prohibition expires after 10 years. And our research showed that that prohibition had a very substantial beneficial effect on risk for violence among the people who were prohibited. It dropped their risk of committing violence by about 30%, which is a big difference.
I thought that no matter what laws you passed, anybody determined to get a gun could get one.
It's just wrong on the facts. What we found, and what lots of other research has found, is that if you make it difficult to get a gun illegally, fewer people will do it. Efforts of various different kinds that make the criminal gun market operate less efficiently result in fewer criminal gun transactions. It's simply not the case that everybody who wants a gun who's prohibited from getting one legally gets one illegally. Is there a small subset? Are there, to use the common phrase, are there hardened career criminals who will go out and get a gun? Yes. But relative to the larger population of people who do crime, they're a small group. And we have cops for them. We have prisons for them. And arresting and imprisoning those people has been shown to be beneficial. So the strategy that many of us talk about, prohibiting legal purchases, doesn't work for everybody, but it works for most people, and that's good enough.
So it strikes me as you're someone who really straddles the two sides on this issue. Member of the NRA, you are familiar with firearms, but you're also an emergency room physician, so you see who's on the receiving end of these incidents, and you've studied it for 30 years. So is it your perception that there is a political solution here that would actually get the support of both sides without hopelessly dividing the nation?
So I think gun violence restraining orders stand a good chance of being a focal point for bipartisan support. Will they end firearm violence? No, of course not. Will they make an appreciable dent? Yes, I think so. Firearm violence is like any other complex health and social problem. There is no one right thing to do. The correct approach is to do a lot of things at the same time. And I think that one thing just might get done.
Hmm. And how long do you think it'll take? You think this is the incident that really has crystallized this in people's minds and will actually lead to some action this time?
I think it already has. I think Florida's adoption of a gun violence restraining order statute over the objections of the National Rifle Association was a signal event. The NRA itself has subsequently come out in favor of gun violence restraining orders, although with some strings that really make no sense. Vermont, I suspect, will take this up. Other states that are considering are states like Utah and Arizona. And I think, at least for this one specific policy, particularly if the National Rifle Association is offering even a qualified and not entirely sensible endorsement, there's probably no state red enough not to at least consider it. So I think we will see some motion on that particular issue. I think we already are.
Do you think anybody's being irrational about this?
Well, yes, there's irrationality at both extremes, but thank you for bringing that up. One of the things that is very commonly overlooked as we focus on the extremes is that the common ground here occupies a much larger percentage of the terrain than people think. I'm going to give you a different example. A policy called comprehensive background checks require that for every firearm transfer, the person buying the gun certify in writing, not only certify in writing that they're not a prohibited person, but that the truth of that answer be checked against the federal databases that we've discussed. Mm-hmm. More than 95% of the population supports, or about 95% of the population supports that policy, but so do more than 80% of firearm owners and more than 70% of members of the National Rifle Association. There really is something approaching consensus on that policy. What we need as a nation is a way to move from consensus to action.
Makes sense to me. Dr. Garen Wintemute heads the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. Dr. Wintemute, thank you very much.
A real pleasure. Thank you.